So today we start with the study of the causal structure of space-time, leading up to the study of singularities and the question of whether singularities are necessarily occurring or whether singularities might just be a special case that arises with complete symmetry. Like as we discussed, when you have a completely spherical collapse, then we know that we can have a singularity because we can have, for example, the Schwarzschild solution for that case. We can have a singularity at the center. And the same with FRW solutions for cosmology. But are there really singularities? Are singularities unavoidable even in non-symmetric realistic cases? So for that purpose, we will need to study what is a singularity anyway, how do we identify them? And for that purpose, first, we need to develop some dictionary of causal structures in space-time. So today's lecture is a little shorter because we did all of this evaluation at the beginning. So causal structure and singularities. Let's begin with a definition, of what is a time-orientable space-time. We say that a space-time given by a manifold and metric is time-orientable if at each event we can separate the non-space-like vectors, so the time and light-like vectors, into two categories, namely the future-directed and the past-directed ones. Both will be time-like or light-like. So we say that a space-time is time-orientable if we can separate the time and light-like vectors into future-directed and past-directed ones in a continuous fashion. Let me give you an example here of where that would not be the case. Imagine if we had a space-time which looks like a soda can, and we have, it's just the surface of it, and we have light cones around the equator of it. And imagine that these light cones tilt as you go around the equator. So you go like this, and tilt like that, tilt like this, and so on as you go around. And as you come back, what used to be future pointing becomes past pointing. In this case, you would have a continuum of light cones. You would have that the light cones continuously change around that manifold here, but in such a way that future and past would be interchanged. It's sort of a space-time version of a Möbius strip. Now that would be a super weird space-time if you lived in one of those. Because not only would you be able to return to, if you went around this equator here, you would find that what you thought was future pointing is actually past pointing. So that means that what you thought was a movie running forward is actually a movie running backward. So you couldn't have a thermodynamic error of time on such a space-time. It would be weird, super weird. We don't expect space-time to be like this. Now here's a lemma. If space-time is time-orientable, as we expect it to be, then there exists smooth, and that's important, because if you allow discontinuities, of course you can just flip the future and the past light cones. Then there exists smooth, non-vanishing, time-like vector fields V on that manifold. Otherwise they don't. So it's a double if, it's if and only if. Right? You can use this non-vanishing time-like vector field that's smooth and non-vanishing everywhere to define what is the future light cone or what is the past light cone. You can define the direction of that vector to be, let's say, in the future light cone, and then you can check that. You can use that to define what is future and what is past pointing for all of the time or light-like vectors. So if such a vector field is given, we can define it, remember, smooth, non-vanishing time-like vector field is given on a space-time, then we can define at every event p the future-directed vectors psi to be all those non-space-like vectors for which the inner product between v and psi is larger than zero. And correspondingly, the path-directed vectors psi will be those non-space-like vectors whose inner product with our reference vector is negative. And of course, we could switch positive and negative around here globally. And why does that work? Well, consider in every tangent space a basis such that the metric is given by eta mu nu, which we can always do. We know that because we can build a Riemann normal coordinate system about every point. And the tangent vectors, the basis in the natural basis that comes with a Riemann normal coordinate system at the origin is a basis such that at the origin the metric g mu nu takes the form eta mu nu. Well, then assume we choose these bases at every point of the manifold, then we can also do a Lorentz transformation such that our time-like vector field looks like this, v naught 0, 0, 0. It's time-like after all, so we can certainly do this. But then, if the inner product with some vector psi is supposed to be, let's say, positive, then what is that inner product? It's this, right? Because we have v 0, 0, 0, so it's very easy to check. So the sign of the psi is well defined relative to our reference vector v. So we can easily use v to define for all other time or light-like vectors whether or not they are space-like, whether they are future or past-pointing, just by checking the relative sign in the inner product with our reference vector v. So we will now only consider time-orientable spacetimes. And we will also assume that a time orientation has been chosen. Now let's look at time-like curves. We say that a curve or a path in the spacetime that is a map from some interval in the real line into the manifold is called a future-directed time-like curve if every tangent vector along the path is a future-directed time-like vector. So we would always be, I mean, in this terminology, we always travel on future-directed time-like curves. Notice that here, it's not allowed that the path is having a tangent which is the zero vector. See, because we want future-directed time-like curves. But for a vector to be called time-like, its length has to be negative. Length zero would be called light-like. That leads us to define future-directed causal curves. Now, a causal curve is a curve whose tangent vector could be time-like, but it's also allowed to be light-like, because both are curves that can have a causal influence. So here now, gamma dot, the tangent to the path, is allowed to be zero formally, the zero vector, because non-space-likeness merely means that the inner product of the tangent vector with itself is not positive. And then similarly, we define path-directed time-like curves and path-directed causal curves. Now let's look at the past and the future of an event. Here we define the chronological future of an event P in the manifold to be the set I plus, capital I plus of P. Now, what is the chronological future? It's the set of all those events that can be reached from P on the future-directed time-like curve. So it's the set of all those events that could be reached by a traveler, an actual traveler, who starts at the event P and then travels at subluminal speeds. So everything that's reachable on a time-like path from P is called I plus. Later we will have other refined definitions, and it may not be easy to remember then what is the chronological future of an event. I suggest a mnemonic device to remember what chronological future means. You know, a clock is also called the chronometer, right? Time measurement instrument. And the chronological future is the set of all those events that can be reached by P by traveling clock, a clock having mass, having to travel slower than the speed of light. Okay? So the chronological future is the set of all those events that can be reached from P by something that has to travel slower than the speed of light. Now, it turns out that I plus, the chronological future of an event P, is always an open subset of M. And that's because if gamma is a time-like future-directed curve from P, then any significantly small perturbation of that path is also a time-like future-directed curve starting from P. Right? Because you can always go a little slower, you can always go a little faster. If you're slower than the speed of light, you can always go a little bit faster. So I plus of P is always an open subset of our space-time. Now, here's a property that we need to keep in mind, just a little technical point. Remember that gamma dot equal to zero is excluded here, because that's not a future-directed time-like curve when gamma dot is zero, because it's not time-like. Time-like would require that the length of the tangent vector is smaller than zero, but the length of this vector is equal to zero. So what we have is that the event itself is not considered to be part of its future. Okay, so the future of an event, the time-like, the chronological future of an event, chronological future I plus of an event P, doesn't include the event P itself. Because if it did, we would have to include the geodesic, not the geodesic, the path that just stays where it is, right, with gamma dot equal to zero, from the event going nowhere. There's only one exception, which would be if the space-time is such that it has a closed time-like curve. Because then you can travel to the future on a future-directed time-like curve, on a future-directed time-like curve, and come back to where you started. In that case, yes, the event would be in its own future. We are going to assume that there are no closed time-like curves on the space-time. So that was the chronological future of an event. Now, another important definition is the causal future of an event. And that's now not called capital I plus of the event, but it's called capital J plus of the event. Now, what might be the difference between the chronological future and the causal future? Well, it's simply that for the causal future, we allow also travel at the speed of light. So that's everything that the event P can causally influence. So this J plus of P is the set of all events that can be reached from P by either matter or light. So that set is a little larger than the I plus, of course. Now we have that the event P is always an element of its causal future, formally speaking. Because now, because it's the cost of future, which means it's the set of all events that can be reached from a non-space-like curves that includes curves that just stand still in the space-time because the gamma dot is now allowed. We have that P is formally an element of the cause of future of P. We have to be a little tedious about, you know, including points or not including points in definitions, because later we want to identify singularities, which can be larger than points, but they can also just be individual points. Now, very similarly to how we define the chronological future of an event and the causal future of an event, we can also define the chronological past and the causal past of an event by simply defining that, for example, the causal past of the event P is the set of, not the causal, this is the chronological past of an event P, is the set of all those events that can be reached from P by traveling on a backwards pointing time-like path. And that would be allowing backwards point, past pointing time-like and light-like paths. Similarly, to defining the chronological and the causal futures and pasts of events, we can also define the chronological and the causal futures and pasts of sets of events. So assume that S, capital S, is some set of events. It might be, for example, some space-like hypersurface on which you want to set initial conditions for the evolution of some dynamics. But it doesn't have to be. Just in general, let's say S is some subset of events in the space-time. Then the chronological future or past of that set of events is simply the union of the chronological past or futures of all the events that in S. And similarly, for the causal futures and causal pasts, is simply take the union of the causal futures or causal pasts of all the events in the set S. Now remember, we already briefly alluded to these sorts of definitions when we defined what an event horizon is. We said that an event horizon is the boundary of the causal past of future infinity of a traveler. So boundaries are important, for example, for defining horizons. So here we define the causal future, the causal past, the chronological future, and the chronological past of events and of sets of events. Now let's look also at their boundaries. And the boundaries are denoted with a dot over them. So I dot plus is the boundary of the chronological future of the set of events S. And J dot minus would be the boundary of the causal past of the events S. So now we recover the definition that we had earlier for what an event horizon is. Assume that S is the set of events traveled by an immortal observer, an observer that goes on forever. Okay, because in order to check whether there is an event horizon or not, you have to actually follow your observer all the way to infinity, to future infinity. So imagine you have an observer, let's say it could be a galaxy, and you follow that galaxy's track, its world line, forever. Let's say the center of mass of the galaxy or something. So that world line is a set of events in space-time. Let's call that set of events S. Then we can look at the causal past, J minus, of that set of events. Okay? That's the set of all those events from which a traveler or a beam of light could reach events in S. So that's everything that could possibly have influenced our center of mass of the galaxy, right? So our observer. This is J minus of S is the set of all those events that could possibly have influenced S by sending matter or by sending radiation to our observer. So J minus of S is the set of all those events. And J minus dot of S is the boundary of those. So that's the boundary of the set of all those events that could possibly have affected our traveling observer. Everything outside that is outside the horizon, literally, of that observer. Because everything that's outside, that's beyond that horizon, everything that's beyond J dot minus of S, are events that will never ever be known to the observer S, because they cannot send matter or radiation fast enough to our observer S here. With a cosmological horizon, for example, there are vast regions of space-time that cannot communicate with us. Now, all of the discussion so far was about trajectories that are, or paths that are either time-like or light-like or maybe space-like. So we focused on the time-like and the light-like ones. But there was no requirement that they are geodesics. They were just any path. Now, what's the relationship to geodesics? But so far, none. However, for Minkowski space, for example, it is clear that there's a close relationship. The chronological future of an event, so the set of events that can be reached by a traveler, for example, by a clock, by a chronometer, the set of events that can be reached by matter from P, is also the set of events reachable by future-directed time-like geodesics from P. Right? Any event that can be reached by any path can also be reached by a geodesic. And the boundary of the set of events that can be reached from an event P is the set of events reachable by future-directed null geodesics from P. This is simply to say that anything inside the future light cone of P cannot only be reached by arbitrary paths with by observers with engines, but they can also be reached. Any place in the future part of the light cone, inside the future light cone, can be reached also by geodesics. And similarly, the boundary of the light cone, of the future light cone, can be reached always by light rays. So far, so good for Minkowski space. But this is not true in general space-time. And the reason is there can be singularities in the way of a geodesic. Still, locally, the situation is for Minkowski space, but globally, is like for Minkowski space, but globally it may not be. So here's the theorem. Assume that P is some event in the space-time, and capital U it's a subset of the space-time, it's a neighborhood of our event, and it's a neighborhood that's chosen small enough that it is geodesically convex. That is a convex normal neighborhood of P. Remember what that means? If you take an event of the space-time, then there's always a region around it, it may be small, it may be large, a region around it which is geodesically convex, meaning that in that region, the geodesic between any two events is unique. You know, space-time can have lensing, for example, and then you can have the geodesics cross each other. But there's always a region around any point that's small enough so that it's geodesically convex. Meaning that any two points in that neighborhood are connected by unique geodesic. Well, under these circumstances, we have that the chronological future of an event, when restricted to the geodesically normal neighborhood, is the set of events reachable by future-directed time-like geodesics, just like in Minkowski space, and also that the boundary of the The chronological future of the event is the set of events reachable by future-directed null geodesics. Null geodesics from the event P. And if an event is contained in the causal future of P, but not in the chronological future of P, what does that mean? It's in the causal future of P, but not in the chronological future of P. Well, it means that it can be reached by null or light-like curves, but it cannot be reached by light-like curves. That means it can only be reached by null curves, right? Then any curve between Q and P is a null geodesic, as we might imagine. But again, that's Minkowski space. Okay, so remember, the chronological future of a set S, I plus of S, is the set of all those events in the space-time that can be reached from S by travelers. That is to say, by future-directed time-like curves, by people with mass. The causal future of a set S is the set of all those events that can be reached from the events of S by matter or by light. That is to say, by future-directed causal curves. Now, in Minkowski space, we have that the causal future of the events S is equal to the chronological future of the events S union with the boundary of the chronological future of the events S. In Minkowski space, this simply says that the full future light cone is given by the interior of the future light cone together with the boundary of the future light cone. The boundary being, of course, what light rays are doing. But what are the properties of the boundary of the interior of the future light cone in general for generic curved spacetimes? So I plus of S is the chronological future of our set of events S, and I dot plus of S is that boundary. Now, before we can write down a theorem about this set, the boundary of the future light cone, the chronological future in general, here's a definition. A subset of the space-time is called achronal if no two points in that subset can be connected by a future-directed time-like curve. That is, by a curve that a clock or anybody else with a mass could actually travel. Okay, so a subset of the space-time is called achronal if and only if the chronological future of that subset Q, so the set of all those points that can be reached by observers with mass, intersected with the set itself is the empty set. So no light can travel from one point of Q to another point of Q. No observer can travel from one event of Q to another event of Q. Light is allowed to do so, but not matter. And here's a theorem about the boundary of the chronological future of a set of events S. So remember, again, S is an arbitrary set. I plus is the chronological future, so it's the set of all those events on the space-time that can be reached by matter from S. And we're looking at the boundary of it. So in Minkowski's space, this would be simply the interior of the future light cone, and then we look at its boundary, that's the dot, which would be just, you know, the actual light rays that bound the light cone. Now the theorem says that I plus dot of S, if it's not empty, is an achronal three-dimensional submanifold of the space-time. So here's the situation. Imagine S as being typically something like a space-like hypersurface of space-time, some place where you want to prescribe initial conditions, let's say. It doesn't have to be. But so let's say we visualize S, our set of events, as some sort of surface here. And then we look at the events that can be reached by matter from S. They are all over here. That's the chronological future of S, where these points on this line of 45 degrees are actually excluded, because the chronological future consists only of those events that can be reached by matter from S, not by light. So these points are actually excluded here. But we are looking at the boundary of that set. So this is an open set here. I plus of S is always an open set. We are looking at its boundary. And the boundary is drawn here. Right? And that boundary, says the theorem, is achronal. It's an achronal three-dimensional submanifold of the space-time, which is to say that matter cannot travel from here to here. For Minkowski space, we knew that, because I plus dot was simply the outside of, it was just the boundary of the forward light cone, and therefore it was, of course, light-like. And therefore it's achronal. But this is just a general statement that's always true for space-times. The first textbook to introduce these concepts, by the way, is the text by Hawking and Ellis. So, for example, in Minkowski space, if S is just a point, then I plus dot of this point is the boundary of the forward light cone. And of course, if no two points, no two points on the boundary of the forward light cone are connected by time-like paths, they're all connected by null paths, all connected by light-like curves. But what about general space-times? Well, it's clear that the closure, the bar here, is to indicate the closure in the differential geometric sense, or in the set theoretic sense, actually, that the closure of the chronological future of a set of events and the closure of the causal future of a set of events are the same. But generally, the closure of the chronological future of a set of events doesn't have to be the same as the causal future of a set of events. Let me illustrate that with a simple example. So let's say instead of a set of events, we just look at an individual event. Let's call it P. Now, let's look at the chronological future of that event P. It's everything inside the forward light cone, right? It's all those events that can be reached from P by matter actually traveling there. Everything in here. It doesn't include the boundaries, which are supposed to be at 45 degrees, but I didn't draw it very carefully. Okay. But now imagine that we took away a point from the manifold. Maybe we just did this out of a whim, but maybe the curvature tensor blows up there. It could be that the curvature, that there's a curvature singularity. There are also other singularities, as we will see. There are conical singularities and things like that. It could be that there is simply a singularity and the manifold is not or cannot be defined. There's a hole in the manifold. There's a point missing for whatever reason, singularity, or we just took it away. So imagine there's a point missing in the manifold. Then What about this business here? Let's see. I plus of P, the set of all the events that can be reached by matter traveling from P, is the inside of the forward light cone. It's an open set that doesn't include these lines. And what's its closure? Well, the closure in the manifold is going to be, you know, the set of all the limit points, if you look at paths that travel inside that set I plus of P. And that means that the closure of I plus of S includes now that boundary here, and that, and this. But of course not that, because it's a whole. There is no point in the manifold, right? There simply is no point. So the boundary of I plus of S contains all of these black lines, not that whole. Obviously, it's not the point of the manifold. Now, what does J plus of S contain, though? That's the set of all those events that can be reached from S, in this case, that can be reached from P, by either matter or light traveling there. You see, what does this set include? It includes, of course, all of the interior, because all of the interior is what is reachable by matter. But it also includes what is reachable by light from P. That includes all of this black line, all of that black line, but not this. Because this part is in the shadow of that hole over there. So the difference between those two sets is that these events here are contained in here, but not in there. See, there is no non-space-like curve between this event and that event. You can travel from here to here, but then you cannot travel there because that would be too shallow. It would be more shallow than 45 degrees. You would have to travel faster than the speed of light, but that would be a space-like curve. And that's not allowed in J+. Okay, so that means we should, in order to remember what we really want to do, we want to identify singularities within classical general relativity. And to that end, it seems useful to study the extendability or not extendability of curves, or of specifically of geodesics, as indicators for the absence or for the existence of a singularity. For this, let us define what we mean by a future or past endpoint of a curve. Now, we're interested in these shadow-like things there. So we say that a point P of the manifold is a future endpoint of a curve gamma if, for all neighborhoods U of P, no matter how small that neighborhood is, there exists a time, a parameter time for our curve gamma, such that the curve gamma is inside that neighborhood for all times later than that time T naught. Okay, so what this says is that a point P in the manifold, of the manifold, is an endpoint, is a future endpoint of a curve, gamma, if no matter how small a neighborhood you choose around this point P, there's always a time T, T naught, after which our curve stays in that neighborhood. That means that the curve, as you go late enough in time, will stay in that neighborhood. Okay, so we choose a point, and then there's this curve that is heading towards our point. It may not hit the point, right? So it could be a curve that goes on like this. Here's our point, and it may or may not hit that point at future infinity, at time future infinity. but it gets arbitrarily close in the sense that no matter how small a neighborhood of the event you choose, there's going to be a time t naught from which onwards our curve stays in that neighborhood. Okay? So remember, p need not be reached by gamma. It could also just approach it. Now, since the point P is in the manifold, it is always possible to extend a curve gamma continuously beyond P. And why is that? It's because P is a point of the manifold, but remember how the differentiable manifold was defined. It's also a topological manifold. There's always an open neighborhood around it. You can always extend further. So this means that the existence of an endpoint indicates not the presence of a singularity. It doesn't indicate a hole in a manifold, but it simply indicates that we chose to end the curve there before it was necessary. So we can write down a curve such that the parameter value runs to infinity, but the curve doesn't. The curve simply runs towards a finite point. It sort of slows down with respect to the parameter of the curve. That's the situation when we have one of those endpoints, future endpoints. Now, we say that a curve, gamma, is future inextendable if it does not possess a future or past endpoint. Under which circumstances can it happen that a curve does not have a future endpoint? Well, remember, a curve is future inextendable, that is to say, it does not possess a future endpoint. Then intuitively, one of the following things must be the case. Either the curve runs off to infinity. It just keeps going forever. In that case, you cannot pinpoint a future endpoint. Right? It just keeps going. Or it just goes in a circle all the time. Or our manifold might hit a hole. It might hit, not our manifold, our path may hit a hole. It may hit a singularity. And that's maybe why it cannot be extended. And of course, that's the case that we'd be interested in. That's an important point because this is what the singularity theorems are usually aiming at. They're usually of the structure of the following structure. Assume that certain conditions are met. For example, the weak energy condition or strong energy condition. And assume that you have a bunch of geodesics that have the following initial conditions properties. Then the conclusion is that at least one or maybe all of these geodesics have this property that they cannot be continuously extended, that they reach a point where they cannot be continuously extended. And you can rule out the other cases as well, and so you conclude that there must be a singularity there, either in the future or in the past. In the past, that's what you would want to prove for the existence of a Big Bang singularity, or in the future, for example, for the collapse of matter into a black hole. So here's a theorem. Assume that a subset C of our space-time is closed, and assume that Q is in the boundary of the chronological future of these events C, and that Q is not in that boundary. Then our event lies on a null geodesic, gamma, inside that boundary. And the curve gamma either has a past endpoint on the set C, or B is past inextendable because it meets a hole or a singularity. So let's look at the picture to illustrate this. So let's assume that C is a subset of the manifold that is closed. So here we have a subset of the manifold. And let's assume, and let's consider an event Q, which is in the boundary of the chronological future. So that, I mean, here's the chronological future I plus, everything that can be reached by matter from C, traveling by matter from C. And let's look at the boundary of it. Now the boundary includes all of this, all of that, and all of this. Then the theorem says that any such event that's in the boundary, so it's either here, there, or there, either has a past endpoint on C. This would be the case for all of these points here. the theorem says that Q then lies on a null geodesic inside that. So if we choose, for example, this event here, it fulfills the condition that it's not in C, that it is on the boundary of the chronological future. And then the theorem says that this point lies on a null geodesic, like this one, inside the boundary here. And that null geodesic has a past endpoint on C, goes here. That's also true for all the events over here, but it's not true for the events over there. That's the case B, because it's past inextendable because it meets a hole. So it's simply formalizing what we saw intuitively already. Okay, and so we are now ready to formulate a strategy, and today's lecture will be over in a minute. I planned it to be short for the teaching evaluations, but maybe it's a little too short. But then it's not like we had too many too short lectures. Okay, so what is our strategy then going forward? Well, let us study inextendable curves. And this includes the following three cases. The inextendable curve might hit a singularity, and that will be our main interest. Or the curve might be running off to infinity, or it might be running round and round forever. Let's briefly look at the case C. That's something that we will need to address, namely the curve gamma going round and round forever. How could that possibly happen? Well, it could happen with closed time-like curves. Imagine you have a space-time in which the light cones, this is some path, time-like path, or light-like path, where the light cones go like this. That would be a closed time-like curve. And in this case, it could go round and round forever, and no future endpoint, but also no singularity. So we'll have to exclude that case. Now you may wonder, okay, isn't that trivial? Didn't we just exclude this? We just say, we don't believe that space-time has that, and that's that. Well, actually, as you will find out, we will not be able to quickly move on to the singularity theorems, because this business is quite non-trivial. It can happen that you have a space-time in which there are no closed space-like time-like curves. So you can't travel back in time. But a tiny perturbation of that space-time might create closed time-like curves. There are space-times that are very close to possessing closed time-like curves. You could imagine that all of these, if this is on the outside of a can, like the equator of a Coke can, then you could imagine that all of these light cones are like starting at, they all look like this. So you can always, the future is always upwards. But now imagine that you, I mean this, let's say that around the equator of that can, all the light cones look like this, okay, as you go around. So you can always only travel in that light cone, which is to the future, which is upwards. But imagine that they, that you change the manifold just a little bit, so that these light cones just go a little bit like this, a little bit further down. Then you can suddenly have a closed time-like curve. So we will need, in order to keep control over the causal structure of a space-time, we will have to make sure that not only does the space-time not contain closed time-like curves, but also it should be stable under perturbations, that this, that you know, small changes do not actually lead to closed time-like curves. And then once we have all of this under control, then we can do the singularity theorems and derive that indeed a cosmological singularity and black hole singularities are basically unavoidable under some weak assumptions within classical physics. Yeah, this is as far as we get today. Okay, see you on Friday. Any questions? Today we have plenty of time.
Yes?
Oh, that is unstable there. And the only example I can give you is the one with the Coke can there. I don't know of any reasonable space-time that, I mean, of any otherwise reasonable space-time that would have that property.
Yeah.
The way we will study this is to look at metrics for which we are close to having closed time-like curves, and then adding a perturbative metric to it and checking that, you know, we have always a safety margin and there cannot be closed time-like curves. But all of this is pretty much in the abstract. I mean, closed time-like curves, see, the weird thing is that general relativity totally allows for the existence of closed time-like curves. It's just that the rest of physics doesn't. Because, you know, how would that work out thermodynamically in a closed time-like curve?
Yeah, I think what it has to be, it means it's
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so nobody knows what implements that censorship. Why space-time, why general relativity doesn't make use, apparently, as far as we know, doesn't make use of all the fancy things that it allows. Non-trivial topologies, for example. Space-time might have holes and handles, could have a non-trivial topology. It could allow for closed space, closed time-like curves. It could allow for non-time-orientable space-times, where you travel and travel, and then suddenly you find yourself in an environment where time runs backwards, where thermodynamic time runs backwards. That would be super weird. Yeah. Well, maybe that just means that general relativity is somehow not properly linked into the rest of physics, because it doesn't know about these fundamental obstructions. Further questions? All right, see you on Friday then.